What is the west of your desire?
The west of my desire. It's so hard because I don't know what the west is. One of the things that I'm trying to think about in the book is if we turn away from definitions of the west that we've had in the past, the mythological kinds of definitions that we're probably familiar with as a place of destiny, of dreams fulfilled, and all of that, what is going to replace that? I don't know the answer to that, but it's one of the things that I think about and I try to wonder about.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Scott Parker about his thoughtful book, A Way Home, Oregon Essays. Don't go away. This book is called in part A Love Letter to Oregon, and you begin the book with a salmon metaphor. You talk about your own sense of disrupted navigation system. What's the central conversation you're having in the book?
When you say love letter, that shows up in the book in the blurb that was provided by Claire Vey Watkins. And I love that she used that phrase because it's how I was thinking about the book myself, as a love letter to Oregon. And typically a love letter is written from some remove. For me, that remove was being in Minnesota long enough that I thought for the first time that it was possible that I might not return to Oregon. So my navigation system, I've made it halfway back. I live in Montana now. It feels like I'm that much closer, but it still feels like I might never get there. And one of the things that I wonder about in the book is there even a place that I'm trying to return to? Or is that a fantasy that I've constructed in my imagination? And I think the answer is that it's both. And so while I want to return to Oregon for personal and geographic reasons, I don't have a sense of wanting to return to the past or to my childhood or something like that. I don't believe in that kind of Oregon. We were talking earlier a little bit about nostalgia, and this book is probably touched by nostalgia. It certainly tries to interrogate nostalgia, but I want to resist the temptation to be drawn into nostalgia because I do see that as a deception that can lead us astray. So it's not that my navigation system is broken, and if it were fixed, I could get back to that. It's that the very idea of trying to get back to that is part of what's broken.
Right, you can never go home again, in a sense.
Right. I take, maybe that sounds like Heraclitus and stepping in rivers and all of that, but I think that's right.
And you write, every time I return home to Oregon, it isn't the home I'm looking for. And you also write, year after year, I make return trips aimed at the place I left, each time discovering that a steady accretion of incremental changes has resulted in a complete discontinuity. What does this discontinuity feel like, and how does it unseat the sense of home? You know, like how are you, in not trying to keen towards the past, but towards the future, how are you imagining it, and what does home look and feel like in that direction forward?
This is something that, outside of the context of just the book, comes up all the time in my day-to-day life. We've been in Bozeman for over 3 years now, and the longer we're there, seemingly the more likely it becomes that we'll stay. And yet part of me is still so formed by Oregon that I still locate myself there. So if we go home, say, for the holidays, I still refer to that as going home.
Right.
And then I'll say, maybe go back to Bozeman.
Right.
Right. I have not once slipped up an accident, you know, and referred right. to Bozeman as home. And maybe when that happens, then I'll look back and recognize that there's been some kind of transition. You know, my mom actually grew up in Montana, and I asked her once when Portland started to feel like home. And she kind of put a number on it and said it was after she had lived more than half of her life in Oregon. But again, that's something she recognized in hindsight. And so I don't know if there will be a corresponding thing or if I will go back there and this will all be kind of a blip. But it does feel like a journey and like I have been exiled in some way.
I want to hear more about that.
God, I don't know how do I get into this on the radio?
Was there a moment?
Well, I think I did it to myself.
Yeah, okay.
So my wife and I left Portland to go to Minnesota for 2 years. And after 2 years, we had a chance to go back or to stay. And we ended up deciding to stay. And that feels like the turning moment. And ever since we made that decision, you know, that's when I started working on the book. That's when I thought maybe we won't go back. So it's a self-exile, but it began a chain of events that I'm still reacting to or still being carried along by.
Like to say no to the return in a way.
Yeah, like as if that were my chance and the door is closed or something.
Right.
And yet I still want to go back. But I guess I want to emphasize this idea that the thing I want to return to is not, you know, insofar as I'm capable of being self-aware and having an understanding of what motivates me, is not to heal some kind of wound or to, like, you know, undo the past. But it's stuff like when I get off the airplane, I like the way the air feels there.
Yeah.
And that's how I think air is supposed to feel. And the trees there look like what I think trees are supposed to look like, and rivers and mountains and so on. Mm-hmm. People act like the way I think people are supposed to act.
Right.
You know, what I think home is.
Do you call it your primal landscape? Or does it feel like also your chosen landscape?
I don't know if I'm in a position to distinguish between the two. I think that it imprinted on me so strongly that whenever I'm somewhere else, I judge that place in relief. I mean, if I can make fun of my sister a little bit, which is one of my favorite things to do. She came out here for the first time and asked, why do they call this place Montana? There aren't any mountains here. And of course, what she meant is the mountains don't look like Mount Hood.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And that made perfect sense to me.
The book is composed of essays and short flash pieces and also a little bit of poetry. And I'm wondering if you'll just kick us off by reading the haiku.
Well, so just before this, I read a haiku of Basho's, and then his is about Kyoto, and then I rewrite it in my own voice to be from Portland. Even in Portland, gray clouds obscuring mountain, I long for Portland.
Can you speak to that sense of like being in a place and longing for it at the same time?
That part does feel nostalgic to me. It is the failure of any particular experience to live up to your imagination of what that experience could be. And that's perhaps something that affects writers, or at least this writer, is a certain removal from experience. And I think that's probably necessary for writing, to be able to take things, to see things from a distance and try to take them into perspective. But it comes at a cost, and that cost is a distancing from things. And so if I'm in the Japanese garden and I'm looking at Mount Hood and it's not quite as Mount Hood as I want it to be, right? Like I can feel myself wanting things to be other than how they are, which is an urge that I try to overcome.
Is it like a dissatisfaction or is it like a craving?
I think what it's like is we're very image-based, right, these days, and I think I probably always have been. And so when you see something beautiful, we're trained to take a picture of it. And so in those moments, part of me can't enjoy something because I have to stop and be taking a picture of it at the same time. And that's what I mean about writing being distancing, is that you always have to have part of yourself outside of yourself witnessing it. And so I think that's all the time what's happening, because that witnessing very often includes judgment, right? Part of witnessing is something is making a judgment between some other experience or some way things might be.
I want to talk about the West in sort of a broader sense. I had a conversation with Maxim Loskatov about the West and the frontier, and, you know, what is a man or a woman to do who is sold on the dream of the West, you know, now in our day and time. And you write about the West as you move, you know, from Minnesota or this direction to Minnesota and back, is across all the open space of America between history and destiny. And I hadn't thought of that definition before of the West. And I just want to understand, like, the West as a place between history and destiny. What occupies that space in your mind?
I remember in fourth grade, we did a unit on the pioneers. And looking back, it was really straight up. They indoctrinated us with the mythology of the Oregon Trail, coming here, free land, infinite possibility, all of that. The East Coast or Minnesota, those just seemed like places I couldn't even imagine. Mm-hmm. It's like we were there however many generations ago. I wouldn't have known at the time. And then we're here, and then that's kind of the end of the line, right?
The Oregon Trail, like literally.
Literally, right? Like you end up in the Willamette Valley, and then where are you going to go? So what's between history and destiny?
Or what's beyond it?
Beyond destiny. I mean, that's one of the questions is that I ask in the book is, for my generation, if you're born in the place that everyone is trying to get to, where do you go from there? As a practical matter, one of the solutions that presents itself, and you can speak to this if you want, is Alaska, right? Because it's the final frontier.
The end of the line.
So there's that. But if you kind of see that just one more place to go is one more place to go, and it really begs the question, what are we running from? What are we running for? That's a harder question, and I think that's a psychic question, not a geographical or even a historical one. How do we find peace with ourselves and with our environments? And I think those are the questions that are facing us, more pressingly so now when you take environmental considerations into account. It's even more pressing, and our failure to answer those kinds of questions is more and more alarming all the time.
I have to stay with this question because that was the question that pierced me, was where is our generation going to go? Because you write that the West is at least as conceptual as it is geographical, which is what you just said. And I think, you know, in my mind, coming from Alaska, which is the last frontier, I always thought, well, of Russia, right? Kamchatka, like that's the next. That's where I feel the pull, but I ended up in the last best place.
Yeah.
So it's sort of this, but I feel that existential anxiety too of like, where, now where?
I mean, I have to imagine that if you have a legitimate sense of infinite horizons, that can be a wonderful feeling. And I think the other place people go is online, right? That's where we do have that sense of, you know, you're never going to run out of links to click on.
Rabbit holes.
Yeah. I think people are in the process of spending lifetimes that way. I'm not sure that satisfies, finally, but it is one way that people are answering the question. I don't, if we're looking for better answers, you know, I'd have to start to sound either like I'm advancing some kind of utopian vision or going way back to much older traditions, but I think it's going to be about community, relationships, sustainability.
That sounds like messages written on your tote bag.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not good at thinking practically about how you achieve those things. But I think if we look around, we can see the consequences of their lack all around us. But yeah, I mean, I'm not super in solving things, I guess. I feel like as an essayist, what I'm trying to do is ask questions, think about things. You know, if I had answers, I'd probably be in a different line of work. I'd probably be, I guess, maybe more active politically than I am.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Scott Parker about his small book of Oregon essays, A Way Home. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You write about the psychic burden that comes after you get what you've wanted and discovered isn't enough and never will be. Have you experienced this?
I think in small doses, yeah. I mean, you imagine if you take something as simple as buying something that you have imagined that you want, and then you have that experience of as soon as you buy it, it loses its sheen. I think that is something that we use. It drives the economy. It drives our daily behaviors. And I think we're constantly learning that we're not satisfied. And so instead of making the obvious induction that the problem is with this entire approach, we think, no, it's that, right, I bought this shirt instead of the other shirt or whatever the thing is. And that shows up in other parts of your life too. I'm quite aware that if I did return to Oregon, I would take very many of my problems and dissatisfactions right with me. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything special in itself about Oregon, right? So,
what do you miss about it?
I miss the rain. I miss being able to run every day of the year. I miss the friends and family I have who live there. I miss the moisture in the air. I miss being able to go to the beach. I miss the neighborhoods that I grew up in and that I know, and the plant life.
I was thinking, you reference Oregon authors, including Ken Kesey, and that opening passage of his book, Sometimes a Great Notion, right? I mean, so full of moisture and brambles and thicket. And I was trying to imagine, where do you see yourself in the Oregon writing tradition or canon, you know, if you could be so immodest as to position yourself there?
I will answer that. I would like to first mention Kesey and say that one of the things that got me into this book in the first place was a long essay I wrote about Kesey, and that book in particular, and getting a chance when I was in college to go out and stay in his beach house. You have wide eyes right
yeah.
now. He had just died, so I wasn't there with him.
Right.
But I did have a chance to stay at his beach house, and that's when I was beginning to be aware of the world of literature and take some interest in it. And so it meant a lot to be able to do that and think about him being there and mourn him a bit at the time, too. He's one of the people that I think cleared a lot of space for writers of the Northwest to have followed. But as much as I admire that book in particular and some of his other stuff as well, I think of my lineage as running more through like Kathleen Dean Moore, David James Duncan, Robin Cody. There are others, but those are some of the ones that come to mind right away. I might also include on that list David Oates, who is my publisher for Kelson Books. He was a big influence on me when I was working on this book. And so for it to have ended up with him really felt like its own kind of homecoming. Maybe I'm just trying to be too cute in saying that, and it feels kind of, it feels a little bit like I'm trying to sell something, but.
I want to talk about the publishing element. When you first got a hold of me, you said, I have a small book of essays, and I thought, lovely. And then it came in and it's literally a small book.
Oh yeah. It's small.
So can you talk just about not only, I mean, and the artwork in it is gorgeous, the size of it and why this size and the art?
I don't know the actual dimensions.
Yeah.
But we were talking about Basho earlier, and David Oates, the publisher, he suggested this size, and he did it by way of mentioning this edition of Basho's Journey to the North that Shambhala had published some years back that is these dimensions. And so we kind of modeled this book, the physical book, after that book. And I think that was his way of kind of playing with that poem of Basho's that I include here. So it was his idea to do this size. It was also his idea to contact Alex for the artwork.
And Alex, his last name?
Alex Hirsch. Uh-huh. Yeah, Alex Hirsch. And she read the manuscript and then produced all of these as original works. And I think they're just perfectly suited to what I wrote. I think it's a really neat collaboration that David has got us involved with here.
In the latter half of the book, you have a section with a series of flash pieces under the title Field Notes from the Diffuse Heart of Oregon. And I was hoping that you would read a couple of them.
Of course. So I would go back to Oregon in the summer sometimes, and I would take these long road trips around the state. I would kind of base myself at my parents' house in Portland, and then I would take off in one of their cars and drive around for weeks at a time. And whenever I would stop somewhere, I would just take out my journal and write about the place that I was. And that's where this section of the book came from. Metolius Springs. That spirit of the Northwest, that richness, the profusion of life, sex mixed up in it. So much production you want to participate, spill out, overflow, create, 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 to be like this river emerging from the earth, full flowing. It isn't there, then it is. You haven't seen a blue jay until you've seen a blue jay. Joyous thump of my heart when I look into these pine woods, when the quietness is the type that promises to bust with. My mood is the sound the river makes, its mythology as wellspring, beauty, natural beauty, but us necessary to make it through observation beautiful. Does the tree make a sound? The river does. I hear it. I am here and nature is here in me. We are in this together. This is in us. The water flows upward now. Why not? The mountain, Jefferson, downstream, up there across the field, all my vision reaches and reaches and grabs hold. The blue jay, the meadow, the dry sunshine on my dust-caked shoes. On the road, wheels pointed at the present, it goes and it goes, wheels turning me into whatever I can think of, and I can think of everything out here where the evergreens point ever up and stillness speaks above a crystal water spring.
The book also covers your relationship with your wife. You write that every harmony is itself the death of a solo. And then you write about going on a solo hike on the Pacific Crest Trail. And I'm thinking about this version of you sitting by this lake alone. Is what do you accomplish, or what? Why did you need to go on that hike alone, and how are you negotiating harmonies and solos?
That's a great question. One of the things that is striking to me about this book when I look at it is how interior it is and how much solitude is in this book. And that's mostly the product of the logistics of the way it was written. And I was oftentimes alone on these trips around the state. Had Sandy been on those trips with me, I would have been happy to have her there. I would have enjoyed her company. I would have thought different thoughts and written different essays. But it's not like I set out to need to be alone to come to terms with something. It's just the way it worked out. But you mentioned the Pacific Crest Trail, and you know, one of these ideas we have in the West about conquering the land, taming the wild, and man proving himself against mountain, and all of these kinds of narratives that we're all familiar with and some of us are tired of, I am simultaneously drawn to those and desperately wanting to transcend them in some way. So being alone in wilderness it can be rewarding and it can be inspiring, and it can be wonderful for all sorts of reasons that don't have to do with a strong sense of accomplishment or heroism. And so unintentionally, just because of my total lack of preparation, I ran into this on Mount Jefferson, where I got into some snow conditions that were way beyond what I was prepared to handle. And I had to face, you know, am I going to cast myself as the hero here and try to make it over this mountain? Or will I do the sensible thing and back off? And that's a tougher decision in the moment than it kind of seems like it should be, or it was for me. And it is perhaps with thoughts of the essay that I was writing that I did turn around. That gave me the ending to the essay I was looking for. Whereas if I weren't writing that, I might have pressed on just to satisfy my own, what, masculine drives or something. But I think this was a question about Sandy, right? If Sandy had been there, I wouldn't have been nearly as far into the snow in the first place. This book needed to go this way because Sandy doesn't have to reckon with Oregon the way I do.
Is she from Oregon?
A little bit. Mm-hmm. She grew up in Wyoming and went to college in Oregon and for a while had family in Oregon. I mean, her side of the family was there for a time. Many of her friends live there now. So it's as much home to her now as any place is. She doesn't have anyone in Wyoming anymore. But it doesn't have the same roots that it has for me. So, you know, maybe I did need to be alone on these trips so I could try to make sense of this stuff for myself.
Will you finish by reading Opal Creek?
Opal Creek, Oregon summer. What does a human being need that is not provided? And you're not going to ask me to answer that, are you?
I think I'm not. I think I'm just going to let that be the last words out of your mouth.
Yeah, I don't. God.
How do you answer that?
Oh, now you are. Now you are.
Is it true that an Oregon summer is all a human needs?
Well, it used to be true. I mean, now we've got fires. I mean, we never had fires when I was a kid that I remember. Right? I remember hearing about the fire out here in 88. Well, out here, you know, in Yellowstone, that one. I wasn't aware of fires, you know, and then I haven't been around for them. I've mostly missed it, but you know, that's a thing there too now. Allergies aside, I almost died once from allergies of all things, but allergies aside, yeah, the Oregon summer is pretty f***ing wonderful thing. Summers here are nice too.
Though Scott Parker calls Oregon home, he lives, for now, in Bozeman, Montana, where he teaches at Montana State University. Look for more information about his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.